Good to be here this evening. We miss Brother Colley. He's down in Texas. Hope his meeting goes well. I know it will. Tonight we're going to study for a few minutes the book of Esther. It's going to be a first for me in that I'm going to attempt to use the PowerPoint with the assistance of my son Jacob. We'll turn the pages, but it's not too long, don't worry. I usually do better on chalkboards, so this is kind of a new thing for me. In Hebrews 4:16, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. The reason I quote this verse first is that in order to come boldly to the throne of grace, you have to have access to that grace through the gospel, through obeying the gospel. At the end of this lesson tonight, we will sing what we call an invitation song to give you an opportunity to obey that gospel, to hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized into Christ. That's how you are added to the kingdom. Unfortunately, out in the denominational world, they leave that out. Very often you hear the denominational world say, come accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior. That's what they use a great deal. Well, that phrase is not found anywhere in the Bible. So that's something to keep in mind. You also have an opportunity if you need to be restored to do so. You also have an opportunity to place membership here at Get Well. Now, I do not offer this gospel plan of salvation just as a formality, but because as a gospel preacher or any gospel preacher, it is our duty to offer the gospel plan of salvation, not just to give a social talk. Sometimes I hesitate to do it at the first rather than the last little sermon, but I like to say it so I know it's been said. I remember several years ago, one of our late sisters, a very fine lady, after I had finished my lesson and given the gospel plan of salvation or invitation at the very first of my lesson, she pulled me aside that evening and chastised me, saying I did not give the gospel plan of salvation. Well, I did not correct her because her being an older lady, but I did. I just gave it a different time. So I just want you to remember that you have an opportunity to think about where you stand spiritually as we look at this lesson tonight. Here is the title of my lesson tonight. One of two titles. Hang 'em High or God Amid the Shadows. Well, that's tough on the neck, isn't it? I got to step back. Hang 'em High, as some of you Western guys know, is the title of a Clint Eastwood movie about hanging. Well, Esther somewhat is a story that involves hanging. It involves, and I don't want to give the story away, of several people. But as another gospel preacher in years past has put it, it also could be entitled God Amid the Shadows. God Amid the Shadows. The book of Esther was written by possibly one of three people: Ezra, Nehemiah, or possibly Mordecai. God's name is not mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther. Yet, his presence is seen throughout the book through the providential means that he uses. In contrast, the king in this story, Ahasuerus, and that's a terrible pronunciation of that word, also known as Xerxes I, the son of Darius, is mentioned no less than 175 times. But God is the central character. Jacob, give me the first page, please, son. All right. Let's look at the characters for a minute here. We have God, never mentioned by name, but his providential means is quite evident throughout the book. He is the main character of this book. book is a book that should be studied. It's only 10 chapters long. And the last chapter is only like 4 to 5 verses. You know, sometimes we find it overwhelming when people say, I'm going to try to read my Bible through a year. And that's a wonderful goal. I've yet to do it. I keep trying. And I'm going to do it 1 year. And maybe you've done it several times and my hat goes off to you. But that doesn't stop you from picking books to study and read. I mean, there's several what we call, let's say, short books in the Bible, and Esther is one of them. I read the book of Esther today in about 40, 45 minutes, and I read it a little more studiously than normal because I was going to preach on it tonight, and I read the whole book. And sometimes you hear people say, well, why do we have the Old Testament? Why bother to study it? Because there's such deep nuggets there. To be honest with you, I was looking forward to preaching tonight, not only because of the privilege, but because this was a cool book, for lack of a word. I enjoyed reading Esther. I saw a video on Esther here a while back. I've studied it. And like so often, when I get up here to preach, I wish I had more time to study. I always go, I wish I had another hour to study the book or prepare my lesson. Esther was like that. Esther was like that. And then you have the other characters. Of course, we have Esther, the heroine. She's the heroine of the story. You have Haman, the bad guy. You have Mordecai, the good guy. You have Ahasuerus, Xerxes, the unwitting tool of God. Those are the main characters of this story tonight. Ahasuerus was the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire had taken their empire from the Babylonian Empire that was ruled by Nebuchadnezzar. Later on, Ahasuerus would lose this empire to the Greeks. This empire stretched from India to Ethiopia, 130 provinces. It was a big empire. He was a powerful man. He was the son of a powerful man. His grandfather was Cyrus. He came from a long line of powerful men. But as I studied the book of Esther, I realized that we're going to have trouble with this word tonight. Easy for you to say. Ahasuerus, why couldn't his name be Job? But was a king. But he wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. He really was not a very bright king. He had a summit in his capital city. And that summit lasted for 6 months. And then in the last week, he decided to have a party. This party lasted a whole week. There was a lot of drinking, a lot of debauchery, and this type of thing. These men were drinking for 7 days. And the town or the city they were was Shushan. You see, nothing's going to be easy tonight. Shushan. So he decided that he was going to finish this party by showing off his wife. So what he did, his wife's name was Vashti. And he called Vashti, and apparently she was a very beautiful woman. And says, honey, I want you to come before my men friends, my banquet, and show off your beauty. This was so wrong. First off, it was wrong in that his idea would have been immodest. And secondly, it would have been against Persian culture because it is implied that she would have to remove her veil and show off her beauty. And this offended her greatly. To be shown like a piece of meat in front of a bunch of drunken men. So she sent word back to her husband, no way. I'm not coming. I'm staying where I am. So you see, in this particular instance, their more noble character is Vashti. Well, Ahasuerus was livid that he was being disobeyed. And one of the reasons he was livid is because he felt like this was setting such a bad example for the women throughout his empire. Because if you read the book of Esther, it says this, and I'm paraphrasing, that he says, now women will feel free to disobey their husbands because my queen disobeyed me. And so what does he do? He divorces her. He fires her, whatever term you want to use. She is no longer his wife. She is no longer his queen. She is a more noble character here, is he not? Well, after his anger subsides, his eunuchs come to him, his advisors come to him, and say, let us basically have what we call a beauty pageant. And pick the most beautiful virgins in your empire to come and basically pick one as your wife or your new queen. And so they did that. They went throughout the lands to pick a woman to be the new queen of the Medo-Persian Empire. And one of the people they picked, one of the ladies they picked, who's described as lovely and beautiful, was Esther. Esther was a young Jewish girl. She was probably in her 20s, not a teenager. She had been raised by her cousin Mordecai when her folks died. Mordecai was probably about 15 years older than she was. Obviously, he was a Jew also. And he encouraged her to be a part, and I'm going to use the word beauty pageant, to go before the king. And that's what happened. They gathered together all the women, and my wife objected to this word, I won't tell you this right away, into a harem. Well, that's basically what it was. So he could find a queen. And she went through 6 months of beauty preparation. And another 6 months of beauty preparation. And that has not changed today, has it? And she came before the king, and the king fell in love. He was smitten with Esther. And he made her his queen. Well, in the meantime, we enter into Haman, the bad guy. Haman could not stand Mordecai. Haman was a very powerful man, a very egotistical man, apparently. And Haman and Mordecai refused to bow down to him. And Mordecai stayed at the king's gate. Now, there's two ideas about this. One, in the commentary I read, just suggests that Mordecai sat at the king's gate. But then I was advised right before services by a commentator named Karen Wallace, who has taught this lesson many times, believe me, kids love Esther. That's a lot of fun. That she has studied and read, and who am I to argue with my wife or my mother, that Mordecai had a job as a gatekeeper. Lambert Publishing, who puts out the Lambert stuff that we use, a good, solid publisher, advocates that also. So he may have had a paid position as a gatekeeper. But irregardless, he sat at the gate. And every day Haman passed by. But Mordecai refused to bow down to him. And this really rubbed Haman the wrong way, because everybody else bowed down to him. See, one reason he hated Mordecai too is that Mordecai was a descendant of Saul of the tribe of Benjamin. And Haman, and you can understand why this man had such a lousy attitude when you hear what he was called all the time. He was called Haman the Agagite. Can you imagine being called that all your life? Come here, Agagite. Well, that was him. Because he was a descendant of Agag. And the descendants of Agag hated the descendants of Saul, which Mordecai was. So that was another reason. And he would have killed Mordecai, but Mordecai had a large following of Jews who were loyal to him. And Mordecai did not want to incur their wrath. So what did he do? He went before the king and says, King Ahasuerus, I think we need to kill these Jews. They're dangerous to your empire. I will pay you, king, what amounts to $10 million. I will put that in your treasury if you let me kill these Jews. And just think, dear king, how much treasure and how much plunder you will gain if you let me kill these Jews. Well, Ahasuerus refused the money. But he said, hey, go ahead and do it. I don't care. And the scriptures say he took off his signet ring and gave it to Ahasuerus so he would have the official stamp of approval to carry out the king's orders, the decree, as they say. See, back then, and perhaps you've seen old movies like Ben-Hur, either with wax or clay, they would imprint the king's seal upon wax or clay to show it had been approved. And so this was quite a lot of power for someone to have the king's ring. And Mordecai heard about this. And it says he mourned and put himself in sackcloth and ashes. And he says, I need to see Esther. See, Esther had kept secret from the king that she was a Jewish woman. So the king had no idea. So Mordecai sent word to Esther, I need to see you. And so they got together. And he says, Esther, you must stand up for your people. You must stand up for your people. And he makes a very persuasive argument when he says, not only will your people die, but you will die. And that's important to keep in mind, that he pointed out, you know, you're Jewish also. If you look in 4:14, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And I'm going to go ahead and read this next verse, because this is such a key verse to the whole chapter, and I will probably hang a peg on it and come back to it. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Isn't that a beautiful passage? He basically lays a guilt trip on her, although I think she was more noble than that and didn't need that. First off, he says, look, you and your father's house are going to be wiped out along with all the other Jews. And then he goes to a second point and says, hey, maybe this is why you're here right now. This was very difficult for Esther. She then tells Mordecai to go to his friends and have a fast for 3 days on her behalf. Because, you see, Esther could just not walk into the king and go, hey, Ahasuerus, I need to talk to you. You had to have an audience with the king scheduled. And if you came into the throne room, the king had to extend his scepter, or he could have you killed. as he came into his throne room. So Esther was running quite a risk. But she went to the king, and she came into his throne room. And you can imagine for a moment, she was breathless and wondering if this would be her last breath she'd take. But the king loved Esther so much, he extended his scepter, and she came forward. And he goes, "What is your request? You can have anything you want up to half the kingdom." This man was smitten with Esther. Esther, for some reason, felt like the time was not necessarily right. But she said, "Let us have a banquet tonight for Haman and you and me." And you can imagine Haman, how he felt. Being the egotistical fellow he was, he gets an invitation not only from the king, but from the queen. "I want you to come and have a banquet with us." And that night, they have a banquet together, but Esther decides, "I'll wait till tomorrow to make my request known about the Jews." So she says, "Dear king, let us have another banquet tomorrow with Haman and you and me." And the scriptures tell us that Haman was so proud that he went and told his wife, said, "Look, the king thinks so highly of me that I'm having dinner with him and the queen." He had a big head. He thought he was it. How quickly things changed. Well, that night, Haman went home. It says he slept soundly. But the king could not sleep. He had a case of insomnia. So he woke up. Sometimes, maybe we've all done this. When I can't sleep, sometimes I'll read or whatever. And he asked his advisors to go get one of the books of records, history books of the kingdom. I mean, apparently he thought, "Well, if anything will put me to sleep, that will." So they brought one of the books in. It was obviously probably a scroll. We call it a book. And he was reading through it, or they were being read to him. And he read where Mordecai, he had forgotten this, had saved the king's life one time. Remember? There were two gatekeepers. Or actually, they were not gatekeepers. He was a gatekeeper. There were two eunuchs who served the king. And they plotted against the king to kill him. And Mordecai had gone to Esther and Esther to the king and warned him. And these two men were caught and put to death. Mordecai saved the king's life. But nothing had ever been done to recognize and reward Mordecai. And this upset the king because he was reading this book of history. So the next day, he calls Haman in. He goes, "Haman, I need to talk to you. Let's suppose that there is a man who has done a great deed in this country and has never been rewarded or recognized. What should we do?" Well, Haman thinks he's talking about him. He has this big grin on his face. "Well, the king's talking about me, obviously. This is it. I have made it." He says, "King, I would get one of the royal robes that you have worn and put it around him. I would get one of your royal horses that you have ridden and put him on it. And I would have a prince lead that horse throughout the city and yell to everybody and proclaim to one another, 'Long live Mordecai,' or 'Long live the man,' whoever it may be, who is deserving of this honor." Haman is so convinced that he is the one. Then the king burst his bubble. He goes, "Haman, that's a great idea. See that it's done." You can see Haman going, "Yes, yes, yes," to Mordecai. "I wish we had a king." You imagine you could have a man's countenance fail there. Haman had to turn around and take a robe to Mordecai, give him a horse, a royal horse, and Haman had to lead that horse around proclaiming how great Mordecai was. He went back home, told his wife these events. His wife says, honey, you're in trouble. Because Mordecai was exalted and honored. And Haman was seeing his star, as we say today, start to fall. And he knew he had dinner that night with the king and queen. And so they had the banquet. And there the three of them are. And the queen makes her request known to her husband, the king, and says, King Ahasuerus, there is a decree out to kill my people and to harm me, the queen. And the king is livid. Who would harm my queen? And you can imagine Haman like the deer in the headlights. The queen turns around and points her finger and says, that man right there, pointing towards Haman, he is the evil one. And it says the king was so angry he left the palace out into his garden. And it says that Haman fell down at the feet of the queen, pleading and begging for his life. He fell across her couch even. And when he was doing that, as he was trying to grab her legs to beg and plead, who should walk in? The king. And he interpreted that she was being attacked by Haman. And whoa, this guy's seconds were numbered. So he orders his servants in there, his two servants. They take Haman by the arm. They take him out. And Haman had a gallows built for Mordecai. And they took him up those 13 steps that were 50 cubits high to the gallows. And they hung Haman on the gallows he built for Mordecai. And then the king could not repeal the decree he had issued for the killing of the Jews. But he did issue a second decree that the Jews could defend themselves. And on that appointed day, when they came to kill the Jews throughout the empire, 75,000 Medo-Persians were put to death by the Jews. Haman was hung, and the 10 sons of Haman were hung by Mordecai and the Jews. And it says that Mordecai was elevated basically to Haman's position, and they ruled in the kingdom. Isn't that a great story? Jacob, next page. But let us look at ending here, the outcome. The plot, as we already know, was to destroy the Jews. Mordecai had told Esther that if you don't save your people, someone else will save your people. Now the question arises, why does God want to save the Jews? And I'll finish up real quickly. Because he had to keep the seed or the lineage of David alive so our Savior would be born. That's the reason. Had to keep that lineage going all the way down from David to Jesus Christ. He couldn't let the Jews be destroyed here. And Mordecai was a man of faith, and he says, look, if you don't save your people, somebody else will. The outcome? The good guys win. This is a classic good guy, bad guy thing. The good guys win. The conclusion, Isaiah 59:1, I think applies very well. Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor his ear heavy
that it cannot hear.
There are people in this land today who believe that only God can work through miracles. That is so ridiculous. That limits the power of God. If you look in the book of Esther, God is not mentioned, but his providential means is threaded throughout the book. No miracles are there. Not a miracle one. But he used his providential means. And as I finish this lesson tonight, I look back at the verse I told you I hung a peg on her ear. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. God has a purpose for every Christian in this room. I'm not counting predestination. That's a falsehood. But maybe you have come into the kingdom, which is the church, for such a time as this. What are you doing for the Lord? Brother Phillips preached a masterful lesson this morning on the evils besetting our nation. But what are you doing to fight these evils? Maybe you're here to fight them. Maybe that's your job. Maybe that's your purpose. Maybe you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this. And again in Isaiah, don't sell God short. He doesn't need miracles to make things happen. That's been proven by this book. I hope you think sincerely and seriously upon these things. Shall we stand and sing?